William Meal, a professor at Yale, was doing some historical research some years ago. He was traveling to some of the historic sites of colonial America. And one day in Virginia, he was touring one of those old homes where there still lived an aged woman, the last survivor of her family, of a distinguished colonial family. And she was proudly showing him the house and all that was in it and telling him the stories of all who had lived there. Over the fireplace in the living room, Dr. Meal noticed an ancient rifle. It intrigued him and he asked if he could take it down and examine it. She replied, "Oh, sir, I'm afraid that wouldn't be safe. You see, it's all loaded and primed to fire. My great-grandfather kept it there in constant readiness against the moment that he might strike a blow for the revolution." Professor Meal responded, "Oh, I see. Then your great-grandfather died before the revolution came." "No," she answered. "He lived to a ripe old age and died in 1802. But he never had any confidence in George Washington." You see, he knew Washington as a boy and didn't believe that he could ever lead an army. Jesus had the same problem. Those who had known him as a boy could not believe that he could speak as he spoke and do as he did and be who he was. The story of Jesus' rejection at the hands of his own townspeople gives us a disturbing reminder that it is perfectly possible to have something right in front of you and not be able to recognize it or see its importance. Do you remember the often told story of the first casting session that Fred Astaire attended? He made himself available for a part in a film. The director would have nothing of it, and the director wrote at the time of Fred Astaire, "Can't act, can't sing, dances a little." In 1902, the well-circulated monthly magazine named Atlantic Monthly received some poems from a writer and returned them to the 28-year-old poet with a bitter note, "Our magazine has no room for your vigorous verse." The poet was Robert Frost. In 1905, the University of Bern flunked a PhD dissertation. Now, if you know anything about such things, to get to the point of your dissertation and fail is almost unheard of, remarkable. Because the writing was fanciful and irrelevant, it was failed. The young student seeking his doctorate, Albert Einstein. In 1894, a rhetoric teacher at Harrow, England, wrote on a 16-year-old boy's grade card, "A conspicuous lack of success in this student." The name at the top of the grade card was Winston Churchill. It is possible to have something right in front of you and not recognize it for what it is, or see its importance. It is possible to be too close to something to appreciate it. The consistent witness of the New Testament is that Jesus was rejected by his own people. First of all, his family. Then his friends. Then his faith community. Then his nation. But in this passage from Mark's sixth chapter, it is Jesus' own people, those in his hometown who take offense at him. They could not believe that Mary's son could say the things he was saying or do the things that he was doing. But the most remarkable part of this story comes at the very end, I think, where it says, Jesus was amazed at their unbelief. Now, I would think that you've got to go a pretty long distance to amaze Jesus. But they managed to do it in Nazareth. He was amazed at their unbelief. But even that is not the most important thing that we need to see here. Consider this. If they did not believe in the goodness and the power of Jesus, it didn't really affect Jesus all that much. He continued on his course and with his mission and his work. If they did not believe in the goodness and power of Jesus, neither did they believe it of themselves. Failing to recognize Jesus for who he was revealed their inability to see themselves for who they were. The real focus of this passage is not who Jesus was or was not, but who these people were and what potential they saw in themselves for serving God in meaningful and powerful ways. When they failed to see it in Jesus, they failed to see it in themselves. But what was so different about Jesus? What was it that caught them so off guard that left them unwilling to accept him and left Jesus amazed at their unbelief? What was so different about what Jesus was doing? What was he doing that created such consternation? Perhaps the thing that made Jesus and his work and his words so difficult for people to comprehend was this. Jesus was focused primarily on responding to God's call. Jesus was interested in doing what God needed him to do, what God wanted him to do, and he was more focused on God than he was on them. He was more interested in God's call than he was in meeting people's needs. So much was that true that he may have seemed to ignore their self-perceived needs while actually addressing what is more essential of life's meaning and purpose. It seems to me we're in something of the same situation now. Often, folks come to church expecting to have their needs met, expecting to be fed, expecting to be served, instead of coming to the community of faith seeking opportunities to serve God, endeavoring to discover what yours and my gifts for doing so are. Somewhere along the way, we have misplaced the ancient vision, the biblical concept of the church as a priestly people, a people set apart for ministry. You know, when we hear that term, set apart for ministry, called to ministry, we too easily think of clergy. Clergy like Pastor Candy and myself and Drew and Don and Mark, and I don't know if there are any other ordinands here in the service or not. Those of us who have been ordained. But in fact, when we hear the word ministry, we should be thinking that all of us are set apart for ministry. Not in ordination, but in baptism. Somewhere along the way, We have misplaced the ancient vision of the church as a priestly people, a people set apart for ministry in baptism. Perhaps we need to revive Martin Luther's vision of the priesthood of all believers, for it was Luther in the 16th century who really captured this biblical understanding of who the people of God are. We, all of us, are ordained by God at our baptism to share Christ's ministry in the world. We are a body of people united by a common vocation. To believe in one's own ministry, to believe in one's own priesthood, is to see the extraordinary dimensions of an ordinary life, to see the hand of God at work in the world, to see one's own hands as necessary to that work. Whether those hands of yours and mine are diapering an infant or assembling an automobile or balancing a corporate account, those hands are God's hands, claimed by God at baptism for the accomplishment of God's design, God's will on earth. God has delegated important work to each of us. What an incredible trust, what an incredible confidence our God has in ordinary people. This is the thing, this is the very thing that the people of Nazareth could not conceive of for Jesus or for themselves. That this one who has come from among us could be called and gifted by God so remarkably, if they couldn't believe that Jesus was worthy and able, they did not believe that they themselves were worthy or able. God has delegated important work to each of us and trusts us and has great confidence in us. As tragic as that was for the people of Nazareth, we live in an even greater danger ourselves. We live at a time and in a society where we face choices daily. And the choices that we face are most often consumer choices. And we've come to view our relationship with the church in similar ways. And we treat choosing a church in much the same ways that we treat choosing between competing brands and styles of basketball shoes. We look for a comfortable place that meets our needs, rather than for a place where our abilities, our gifts, can be employed in the service of God. What would happen if we started doing the things that we do, whether we are singing in the choir, even if it's just a choir of one, whether we are singing in the choir or preparing a meal for our family? What if we started doing the things that we do, not because it's what we like to do, not because it feels good to us, not because it makes someone else like us, but because it's what God wants and what God expects of us? While we spend our time asking so often what people want, what we want, we ought to be asking the frightening question, what does God want? What does the Lord require of me? That's the fundamental question. Surely that day in Nazareth, someone left the synagogue saying, "I'm sorry, but that new preacher just didn't do a thing for me." Some of them, maybe a few, not many, realized that Jesus was about something far greater than just me. Mostly they were offended by him because he dared to believe that he and his work were in God's hands, and he dared to see the same potential in them. There's an old story told about a man named Ali Fasid. Ali had a small farm and a family. One day, the story goes, a Buddhist priest came by and talked with Ali Fasid. "You know," he said, "there are in the world valuable stones called diamonds. And if you get one of these stones, you could be a wealthy man." Ali Fasid went to bed that night, but he could not get the priest's words out of his mind. He must find for himself one of these diamonds so that he could become wealthy. He could become a ruler. So he sold his farm. He put his family out to neighbors. And he went to find his own acres of diamonds. And he searched vigorously. Months passed, and he found no diamonds. He was broken in body and in spirit, and his money was gone. At the Bay of Barcelona, he threw himself into the water, never to walk the earth again. Meanwhile, the man who bought his farm bent over one day as he was plowing and picked up an odd-looking stone. He took it into the house and laid it on the mantle, not knowing what it was. A few days later, that same old Buddhist priest came by and he saw the stone and he exclaimed, "Ali Fasid must be back from his search. He has found the diamonds." "No," came the response. "He has not returned." "Then where did the diamond come from?" And the farmer replied, "I was out plowing in the garden, and I found it there. And you know, my friends, the story goes that from that very garden, not a legend but a true story, from that very garden came the diamonds that adorn the crowns of the kings and the queens of Europe to this day. Europe and Russia. All in Ali Fasid's own backyard, there were acres of diamonds, and he knew it not. And so it was in Nazareth. Acres of diamonds, grand and glorious potential for serving God. Jesus was there. He saw it with his own eyes. Grand and glorious potential for serving God, for changing the world, for changing history. And they knew it not. And were offended when their very potential, their very own potential, was shown to them. And so it is in Mechanicsburg. Right here at First United Methodist Church, in the midst of you, acres of diamonds, grand and glorious potential for serving God, for changing the world, for changing all of history. Why are you here anyway? Are you looking for something that meets your needs, that makes you feel good? Or are you seeking a place, a community, that provides you with the opportunity to serve God? We pray and we sing today that God will open our eyes and our ears, our hearts and our minds, that we may see in ourselves and in our community of faith the great potential which Christ has put here. Not potential for serving our own needs and making of ourselves a wonderful place and a wonderful family, but potential for serving God, for hearing the call of God and giving ourselves to those things, those endeavors which God desires to accomplish in our place and in our time.